your heart and mind for what he wants to say. And he always blesses the public reading of his inspired and his infallible word. Tonight, for 20-25 minutes or so, I want to just introduce you to what we are going to do over the weekend, if that's all right. And also give you a little bit of a kind of awareness about myself. I want to spend the weekend talking to you about joy. The book of Philippians has many themes. Some would suggest that its central theme is joy. I'm not sure that that is true. But it is one of its central themes. It has a theme of unity. It has a theme of preparing the people that receive it for either suffering that has just begun, you pick that up in 1:27, or suffering that is imminently about to start. But it certainly has a theme of joy. But that theme is written in a way that is strange to our, if you are Western European, not everybody will be, but those of you that have been taught or educated in a Greek or a Latin style of education will find reading this book difficult, as you would find James difficult or John difficult, either his gospel or his epistles. And I'll explain why. We are taught, most of us, not all of us, but most of us are taught in a linear fashion. We are taught in segments and in chunks. But much of the New Testament is not written like that. So when we take a very Greek or a very Latinized approach to reading John or James or Peter, what we end up with is trying to pick out this thing that is chapter 1, and then the theme of chapter 2, and then the theme of chapter 3, and then the theme of chapter 4, and we systematize it more than they systematize their writing, or in a different way to the way they systematize their writing. Because when you read Philippians, for example, all the way through this book, traced in and out like a thread that you can see and then you can't see, a thread that is visible and then invisible, are these ideas. The ideas of unity, the ideas of joy, of perseverance, of faith, of prayer, of trustworthiness, of preparedness in the face of suffering. So I could, if you like, have taken any one of those strands to explore with you, but it's the strand of joy that I want to unpack with you for a number of reasons. Partly, I think, because there is a sense in which we need to grapple with what real joy is. A joy that isn't based on circumstances. A joy that isn't based on events or happenings. A joy that isn't equated to happiness. But the kind of cliche Christian arguments around joy that say, well, joy isn't happiness, are not actually true. There is a connection between the two. The Irish apologist and writer C.S. Lewis got that very clear, particularly in a book that he wrote called Till We Have Faces, where he talks about the power of joy in transforming our lives. The American pastor and theologian John Piper has written a great deal about Christian hedonism, the idea that as we pursue that which will bring us greatest joy, we will discover real lasting joy that leaks out of us, that seeps out of our souls. And our problem is that we seek contentment and joy in things that are less than God. And as a result, our joy is not as full as it could be. Hence verses like, the joy of the Lord is my strength, or at his right hand are pleasures forevermore. Ideas like that. Why Philippians and why joy? And how are we going to explain it? And what way are we going to journey through it? And a little bit of an introduction about me. All at the same time. Well, the way we're going to explore it is, imagine for a moment, I'm going to ask you to think slightly differently this weekend. Imagine for a moment that you are in the most wonderful entrance hall of an art gallery, maybe the Guggenheim in New York, or the museum that they opened in Amsterdam. And what you notice about them is that they have this amazing way of using light. They have a spiral staircase that goes right round the edge, all the way up to the top of the building. And I want you to imagine that for a moment, from the middle of that foyer, from the ceiling, is hanging the most spectacular chandelier, full of light. The crystal glints and bounces. The colours of the rainbow are refracted off it as you walk around it. That's the way Hebrew people thought about ideas. And the chandelier in my image is joy. The staircase is the book of Philippians. And I'm going to ask you to walk around it and look at joy through four different lenses that we find in Philippians. Rather than in a linear fashion, although there is a level of linear argument to be set out for us, there has to be. Rather than a linear kind of this, 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 and this, I want you to walk round the staircase with me and look at joy in Paul's life through different from different angles. It's the same joy, but it looks different depending on the circumstances that one finds oneself in. If you are in the midst of heartbreak and pain and sadness, joy doesn't look like laughter. Joy looks like a deep sense of the capacity to endure. If you are in a context where you have to make a choice that fills you full of dread and fear, joy looks like the capacity to make that decision and not be consumed by fear. If you are trying to understand who you are and where you come from and what shapes your life and what sits at the very center of the culture of your existence, and you have had a complex or a challenging or a fractured past, joy looks like discovering that that past is not as powerful as your future. And that what God has said over you and in you and about you produces a joy that even your past can't destroy. And if you are facing uncertainty and you need to be reminded that even when your world is caving in and your life feels like it is sand slipping between your fingers, and you are walking along fragments of faith that have been broken and torn apart 1,000 times, joy looks like being reminded that you can do anything through Christ Jesus who strengthens you. So I want to walk through the four chapters of Philippians with you, stopping along the way to look at four different facets, four different refractions of the chandelier of joy in our lives. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And here's what those four refractions. Now, somebody likes that. Do you like that analogy? It really helps, doesn't it? Our problem is we just want to get on an escalator, note everything, and get onto the next space. And here are the four refractions that we're going to use. The first one is suffering, which we'll look at tomorrow morning. Trial and heartbreak and pain and sorrow and sadness. When your life cascades in upon you, how do you survive it? I'm going to use a phrase, joy in the midst of heartbreak, how to dignify the trial. And we will explore some of Paul's own context, particularly from Philippians chapter 1, but also from other parts of the book. Where was he when he wrote this? Well, most of you, or all of you, will probably know that he was probably, almost certainly, in jail in Rome. What was he facing? Uncertainty. Possibly death. We pick that up from the end of chapter 1. He talks about not knowing whether he's going to survive the trial or not. Being convinced that he is, and then convinced that he's not, and saying, I'll come and see you, but if I don't, then I'll see you in heaven type stuff. How do you dignify a trial? How do you find joy when you are in the darkest moments of your life? We'll look at that tomorrow morning. The second refraction that we are going to look at is joy in our capacity to face fear with faith. And we'll do that by looking at the life of one man in particular who is almost seen as a footnote in the book of Philippians, a man called Epaphroditus. And we will pause and reflect on this man. We'll reflect on all the characters of chapter 4, but particularly Epaphroditus, and ask ourselves, what can we learn about joy when we are people who are fearful of trying something new? When fear is greater than faith, how do we switch that around? When we like certainty rather than uncertainty, when we would plump for that which gives us assurance rather than that which leads us into uncertainty, even if God is leading us into that nomadic place, that unknown place. How do we find joy in those circumstances? And looking around the room, and having done a little bit of research about Veve and the areas around it, that uncertainty might have been foisted upon you by business collapse or business reduction. Some of the people that you live or work alongside may have been impacted by things like Nestle's reduction, some of the challenges that are faced around business and finance and economic constriction. Some of you, I guess, will be facing uncertainty because you have been living something of a nomadic lifestyle. You're not fully Swiss, and yet you love it here, but you may not be able to afford to die here. You might have to make decisions about uprooting yourself, uprooting your family, or the family that you uprooted and left in the first place. You might have to do it again, but this time you will be leaving children behind and stepping into a territory that you are not familiar with at all and trying to work out how you settle. You might feel a little bit like you live in a limbo. How do you survive in that with joy? How do you flourish in that space? That's the second refraction that I will pick up with you. The third refraction is around your identity. Living out of who you are as determined by God rather than by your culture or by your upbringing or by your paycheck or by the number of employees that you've had or your title or your position. Because all of those things change. And we will explore Paul's words about himself as we reflect on that. This man who had the most remarkable privilege and powerful education. A profoundly important figure in Jewish culture. And how he views that after coming to faith in Christ. And the difference that that makes in him. The transformation of his understanding of his personhood, which is one of the most remarkable in any bit of literature, let alone scripture. This man is one of the greatest thinkers the world has ever known. And because those of us that are Christians are used to his writing, we can forget that. We can forget that he is alongside Plato and Socrates and Aristotle in terms of his thought and his capacity to understand the world. And yet here in this book he talks in simple terms about an identity that is so profoundly important to him that his whole life up to the point that he has encountered Christ is regarded with a different degree of importance. How do we have joy in who we are as determined by Christ rather than as determined by the world around us? And the fourth and final session that we will have, which will be on Sunday morning, will be joy in every situation of life. And we will particularly unpack Paul's closing remarks to the Philippians around this remarkable sense that he says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. What does that mean and how does that work out in us? Those are the things that I want to unpack with you, and I want to kind of explain to you a little bit why I want to do that. Philippians as a book mentions joy 16 times in 4 chapters. That's quite remarkable, or rejoicing. I see many of you taking notes, always an encouragement to me. In Philippians chapter 1 verse 4, he prays for them with great joy. In Philippians chapter 1 verse 18, as you heard read to you this evening, he rejoices in the proclamation of Christ, and he says it twice, as he does at the end of the letter in chapter 4. In verse 25 of chapter 1, he says that his whole purpose is remaining on earth for their progress and their joy in the faith. In chapter 2, verse 2, he appeals to them to be unified so that his joy might be complete. In chapter 2, verses 17 and 18, he says, "Be glad and rejoice." They're used twice in both verses to connect the idea of the challenge of his ministry and the imperative of his purpose. In chapter 2, verses 28 and 29, he encourages them to welcome Epaphroditus, the man I'll talk about tomorrow, with great joy and welcome him in the faith. In chapter 3, verse 1, his imperative to them is to rejoice in the Lord. In 4, verse 1, he describes them as his joy and as his crown in the Lord. In chapter 4, verse 4, he uses a double imperative. Rejoice. Again, I say, rejoice. And in verse 10, he says that he rejoices in their renewed concern for him. That's remarkable, given that he's facing death. Given that he is uncertain of his own future. How can he do that? I am fascinated by that. How can a man who is so restricted, who is so curtailed, who is so watched, criticized, rebuked, attacked, how can he flourish in joy? To be shipwrecked once is unfortunate. To be shipwrecked twice could be considered foolhardy. To be shipwrecked 3, possibly 4 times. Well, I'm not journeying with you. And yet, even in Acts 27, in a powerful narrative story of Paul's shipwreck off Malta, when he describes a wind that was colloquially known as a great northwester sweeping down upon the boat and destroying everything, and everybody being afraid, even there he has this profound sense of joy. We'll look at that more tomorrow, but I want to try and understand from him, what is it about it? What is the core DNA of this man's spirituality that sustains him with joy in so many circumstances? Many years ago, I was preaching in a church, and I was preaching on a verse from 1 Peter that says, God's joy to us is a joy that is unspeakable and full of glory. Do you know that verse? And as I was leaving, as the people were leaving, I was shaking hands at the door, and there was one man particularly who just looked very unhappy. He had an unfortunate grimace that was on his face and would not remove. Those of us that have those types of faces know how unhelpful that can be at times. But he looked angry. And I said to him, "Are you all right?" He said, "Oh, yes, I'm fine." And I said, "Do you have any comments or reflections on the message this morning? You know, it's about joy." And he took my hand and he said, "Brother, please remember it is a joy that is unspeakable." And I'm not sure that that's exactly what that verse means. And yet I know what it is, personally, to find it hard to express joy. So let me introduce a little bit about myself and why I think this matters. To me, anyway. So I'm married to Debbie. We have 4 children. Matthew is 25. I'm not old enough to have a 25-year-old. Benjamin is 23. He's about to turn 24. He's married to Ellie, who is the same age as him. They lost a little baby at the end of last year, but Ellie is 17 weeks pregnant on Sunday, which means I'm going to be a grandfather, which is a rather frightening thought to me. I'm going to be called Papa, if you're interested, because I think granddad's a bit I'm not ready for it yet. I need some counselling for that before I can get it. Anna is 22, and Riona, our youngest daughter, was 20 on Tuesday. And she's studying theology and philosophy at Edinburgh University. Anna's a lawyer, Benjamin is a pastor, and Matthew is a journalist. And I come from Northern Ireland. Debbie comes from the very north of Scotland. She would love to have been here this weekend, but she's unable to be because she's unwell. She has some significant investigations that are happening at the moment. So she just can't be with us. She sends her apologies. Joy for me has become an increasingly important thing to reflect upon because of the last 4 or 5 years of my life, really. But my upbringing was a pretty tough one. Born and brought up in a working class environment in Northern Ireland, and the youngest of 5 children, significantly abused and neglected. My earliest memory is hitting a glass door with my foot because I was afraid and couldn't breathe. My father had tied me into a gas oven, and I can remember breaking out of it and landing on the kitchen floor with the stench of urine around me and nylon pyjamas sticking to me. And he would grind tablets and put them on the top of my cornflakes and my cereal. Didn't call me by my name, which is Malcolm, until just before my 29th birthday. When I became a Christian, he announced my death in the national newspaper. And that was us for 15 years, 14 years. So I guess in some ways joy for me is not an academic subject. I don't walk around this chandelier to enjoy it. I walk around this chandelier because if I don't have this light in my life, I'm finished. And over the last 4 or 5 years, that has become increasingly important to me. In July 2014, my nephew, who was 25 at the time, my sister-in-law, beg your pardon, who was 54, committed suicide. And that spiraled my family into a terrible season of darkness and despair. I'm the only Christian in my family. My mum became a Christian, but she died. I'll tell you about that in a minute. So when Valerie, my sister-in-law, died, my family was plunged into this despair, and I was the only believer and having to navigate my way through it. 4 months later, in November of that year, my 25-year-old nephew, my sister's only son, so not same family, my siblings, but a different sibling, he hanged himself. And it felt like 2 nuclear bombs had exploded in our lives in 4 months. So I buried him. And 20 weeks to the day after he died, his father killed himself, heartbroken at the loss of his son. And I buried him too. And my sister, who had gone from a wonderfully happy family to devastation, was rattling around in the dark trying to work out how to keep living. At that time I was still living in England, so I was travelling backwards and forwards to Northern Ireland 7 times in 8 days, and I did that for 2 years. And I was exhausted. And then 7 months after that, my brother, whose wife had committed suicide, died out of alcoholism. He started drinking the day his wife died and stopped drinking the day he died. And 5 months after he died, my mother died. And then my daughter-in-law's mother died. And then she lost a baby. And it was just this catalogue of despair. Everywhere I looked. And I don't know whether you've ever had this experience. I'm sure some of you have had worse. I'm not trying to tell you that, you know, my life has been a disaster. It hasn't. But you get to a place where you think despair sticks to you. I remember having a conversation with a friend. And he said, "How are you feeling?" I said, "I feel like I stink of death. I feel like it is dripping out of me." And here was I, a follower of Jesus. I didn't lose my faith throughout that. I didn't lose my sense of God's faithfulness. but I didn't feel him. I didn't sense his nearness. I didn't have that sense of his close proximity to me. And he began to speak to me profoundly through Philippians and through Paul's life and through joy, challenging me to unpack in my life the places that I was looking to for joy, the relationships that I thought were the sustaining, joyful relationships in my life. And brick by brick, he demolished those things that were idols and then rebuilt something else. Now, I don't know where you are tonight, but I hazard a guess that some of you are in tunnels of darkness. And nobody else might know, or those closest to you might know. I don't need to be particularly gifted to know that in this room there will be people that are widows, that are brokenhearted, people that have lost loved ones, people that are fighting illness, people that are uncertain, people that are sad, people that are living with anxiety disorders, people that are getting treatment for some of the things that nobody else knows about. And in the midst of it all, church, which is supposed to be the place where we can be most honest and most vulnerable and get most support, can become an extremely lonely experience. And it can be hard to sing the songs of victory and joy and celebration and resurrection and life when all around you, all you feel is death and despair and sadness. And someone exploring Paul, I think, has helped me to navigate those straits. I don't think I'll ever be the same again. You know, people say to you things like, you get over a loss. No, you don't. Whoever wrote that or whoever came up with that idea has not gone through it. You learn to live with it. You never get over it. I was trying to explain to a little person in one of our family circles. He was very sad at one of our funerals. And he said, I don't know why I keep crying. And he said, I think I'm going to cry for the rest of my life. And I said, you won't cry for the rest of your life. But you'll never forget the person that you loved. And learning how to live in a different paradigm is important. And Paul's words to the Philippians teach us something about that around joy. None of you are living plan A lives. Nobody does. Nobody has a plan A life. No human being I've ever met, and I've preached to around 2 million people in 34 years, has a plan A life. We're all dealing with things that we didn't expect. We're all in circumstances that are somewhat unpredictable. We've all lost somebody too early. We've all faced decisions that we've had to make. We've all made mistakes. I'm always wary of those people that when you talk to them about your Christian life and say, is there anything to change? They're, no, not a thing. Never done anything wrong. I either want your pills or want to take you to see a doctor. So as we unpack this, as we explore it, there's something about the culture of Paul's life in Philippians that can change the culture of my life. Imprisoned and isolated, yet aware of God's grace and presence. Facing opposition, yet knowing that God is with him. In despair and yet not despairing, broken and yet not destroyed, uncertain but not unhopeful. What is it about him that enables him to live with joy and hope no matter what? What was the culture of his life? What were the key convictions that held him through the storm? What was the posture of his life? And what's the posture of yours? There's a world of difference between living like that and living like that. There's a world of difference between a relationship with God where I stand defiantly or I kneel submissively and dependently. I can't answer these questions for you, but there are things that will come up over the next day or two. And what were his expectations in life? I wonder whether sometimes joy in our lives is mitigated down because our expectations are not realistic. Or we have a warped theology around certain elements of God's promises to us. And as a result, our expectations are here and our experience is here. And what were his assumptions about his life? What were the guiding principles that upon which he built the foundations of who he was? I think joy is possible. And I would say now, Malcolm Duncan, who is 49 in 2 weeks, is a completely different Malcolm Duncan to the guy I was when I was 44. And I didn't expect that. I think I see the world differently. Where I once saw, and I mean this literally, where I once saw light blue, I now see deep red. I see colour differently. I can't explain it to you. We'll try and unpack it tomorrow and on Sunday morning. Because of sorrow and joy, when I listen to music, it sounds different. It is more beautiful. I'm less hurried. My conversations are more intentional. The people that I relate to have my attention more when I am talking to them. I'm less anxious about many things that I think perhaps sometimes take too much prevalence in our lives and in our thoughts. My faith is simpler. I have more questions than I've ever had. But I honestly can say this to you. I love God more than I've ever loved him. I am not a touchy-feely person. But I am profoundly happy. I have a profound sense of joyfulness that sits at the very depth of my soul, which I have discovered through sorrow and suffering. And I think this weekend God might want to do something in your soul that implants joy at a deeper level and holds you through storms. And I think it will all come from Philippians. That's me. I'm done.